Tudor Museum. There's a $100,000 prize that was offered for the first program that'll pass the Turing test. So they ran the first test last November. The judges were, the thing was run by Dan Dennett, who's a well-known philosopher and cognitive scientist. One of the main judge was Quine. Block was one of the observers, and a whole bunch of distinguished computer scientists and artificial intelligence people and so on took part. And in fact, I'll describe what happened, but the idea was that if a program would pass the computer, none of them quite passed the Turing test, that if a program did pass the Turing test and would fool people, then indeed there would be no reason not to say that it has a mind. Now, Ned Block himself is sort of skeptical about this for various reasons. So speaking of him as a person, yes, he's skeptical. But the field takes this as the definition. That's AI. In fact, strong AI takes an even stronger position, which includes thermostats. Okay, but weak AI is the position that the mental is the computational, just as Block designed it. And then you pick a performance criterion. And the usual criterion, the criterion that defines the field of artificial intelligence, is the Turing test. Personally, I agree it's total nonsense. But that's the way the field is set up. That's why distinguished people showed up to be judges in this competition. Incidentally, just to tell you what happened, the programmers were allowed, the people who programmed the machines were allowed to select the topic that the, they had a jury, not one judge, but like a jury of 10 people or something. And the programmer was, the person who submitted the program was allowed to select the topic of the questioning. So, you know, one person picked Shakespeare and one person picked, I don't know, something else. One person picked, we were trying last night to find a good translation for this in Catalan, but nobody could figure it out. In English, it was whimsical conversation. I don't know if anybody figured out the right translation yet, but what it means is conversation that is just kind of light and a little comical and has no point to it. And is that what it is? Okay, so. That was the winner. And the way the program was designed is it produced cliches at random. Okay, so you push a button, the questioner asks something, and out comes some cliche picked at random. And then you ask something else, and out comes another cliche picked at random. And people were pretty much fooled. A lot of people thought, yeah, that's a person carrying out a whimsical conversation. And maybe if you had sharpened it up, you could fool more people. So that won the prize. That won $100,000. And I should say, this is enough already to show that the whole business is total absurdity. I mean, it's not that anybody ought to be taking this seriously. But it is taken seriously. That's why all of this stuff goes on. That's why you have a field of AI and strong AI. That's why people like, say, John Searle, to whom I'll return in a moment, gave an argument against it, which now, you know, has led to a huge debate with Dennett and Hofstadter and all sorts of others. Ned Block personally is skeptical, but the account that he gives of the computational theory of mind gives no basis for skepticism, because he has no sharper notion of performance criterion. He doesn't offer a tighter notion of performance criterion, either in that article or anywhere. What is the reason? Why? Oh, no, but see, when you bring in the Turing test, you beg the question. Because when you bring in the Turing test, you've already explained why people are part of it. Look, the Turing test is defined in terms of people, okay? So once you use the Turing test as your criterion, you have explained why people are part of this. Namely, your criterion is the Turing test, which uses people. But the question is a different one. Why the Turing test should be the criterion? Why not some other criterion?
There are
Yeah, like this whimsical conversation program. If he had done that, he would have won $100,000 at this competition.
No.
Yeah.
This program that is about is not.
Oh, okay, fine. We're only talking about realizable programs, of course. We're talking about programs that are in terms of the processors. Sure, we're not talking about unrealizable programs. That we throw out. We're talking about programs realized in terms of the processors. That means realizable programs. And if somebody knew how to do it, they would immediately enter the... If you think you know how to do it, enter next year's competition and you'll come out with $100,000. I mean, no matter how stupid it is, that's worth doing. The fact of the matter is, you know, I want to stress how seriously this is taken. The National Science Foundation gave $100,000 or something to support this. It's got all kind of foundational support behind it. It's got a huge raft of major people in the computer sciences and philosophy and so on participating. There's a fringe of skeptics. It's not everybody. Like, there's a guy in the Harvard computer labs who wrote a critical comment on it and so on. And Ned himself, who was one of the observers, thinks it's a joke. But it's taken very, very seriously. In fact, Dan Dennett, who is the organizer and who certainly takes it seriously, made some comments that sound ludicrous, but it's not so obvious why they're ludicrous. He said that if there was a program that really passed the test, you know, if somebody, this is before the test was run, if somebody submits a program that really passes the test, he says that's going to raise serious moral problems. For example, are we allowed to unplug the computer afterwards? Since this computer now has mind, because mind is, after all, just being able to pass the test, would it be immoral to unplug the computer? Actually, that's the wrong analogy. The question is, would it be immoral to reformat the disk? You know, it doesn't matter whether you unplug the computer or not. And, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but if you've gotten as far as Ned Block's article, you know, thinking of the computer model of the mind as a non-biological subject and having mental properties like, you know, the properties that make us moral agents or whatever, as being purely computational properties, then the question does arise whether you're carrying out an immoral act if you reformat the disk. In fact, even deeper problems arise, one second, that he didn't discuss and that others didn't discuss, and that is, why shouldn't all the people who participated in this already be jailed? The fact is that the programs that were given performed much better than monkeys did, and nobody would reformat the brain of a monkey after this. In fact, if you did, it would be a criminal offense. There are laws about proper treatment of experimental subjects. You know. And in fact, experimental subjects have to sign consent forms. None of these programs sign consent forms. So in fact, everyone who participated in the experiment is already in violation of law if having the psychological properties of a person, the properties that make us subject to moral judgment, to moral decision, and so on and so forth, if they are simply software problems. And that will be true if psychology, that is the study of the mental entirely, is a purely computational study, divorced in principle from any biological or physical consideration. If that's the way it is, it's hard to drop these questions. And if the questions seem ludicrous, as they should, then you have to ask, A, why do serious people get involved in it? And B, what went wrong with the argument? Because something must have gone wrong with the argument. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Yeah. They do believe it. Of course they believe it. But what does Ned Block believe is the criterion?
Is to have
some... But the only... But, you know, he... He says that... It's true you can't put him in it because he doesn't accept this. So he's not in the same category as Dennett, Quine, Dudney and computer science, McCarthy and the rest of them. Ned Block himself isn't. But the characterization that he gives of the computer model of the mind is in that category. Because all that's required for the computer model of the mind is that it be built out of processors that which can be made out of anything, and then you have to say, well, it has to satisfy some criterion. But the only criterion ever anyone suggested is Turing's. And in fact, the whole field of AI, both in philosophy and cognitive science, is defined in terms of Turing's proposal and Turing's 1950 paper. That's the whole thing. There's nothing else. I mean, it's true that Bloch says, look, there's got to be something else, but there's nothing else stated. All right. Let me concede your point, although I don't agree. Suppose that Ned Bloch has some other... Right. Fine, then let's stop talking about Ned Bloch. And now let's talk about this field, okay, which has this criterion in mind, namely passing the Turing test. Okay, that's the field I'm talking about. And in fact, that's the only one that I know of that exists. But that's the one I'm now talking about. And that's weak AI. Strong AI says it doesn't even matter if you pass the Turing test. Weaker forms of computation are allowed. Okay? So I'll put aside here the skeptics who think something else is needed. I don't know what. Actually, for a naturalist, it's obvious what is needed. What is obvious is to reject the abstraction in principle from biology. That's what's necessary. So, well, for any naturalist, the mistake was to abstract in principle from biology. In fact, if you do that, you get all kind of craziness. For example, you could make up a field of abstract biology, let's say, in which you set up certain processors that have some of the properties of cells. You say, you take some of the properties of cells, okay, and consider them abstractly, and consider the set of processors that have those properties. Set up some criterion. It can be, if it's AI, it would be a performance criterion. If it's something else, it would be undescribed yet. It would be having some structural similarity to organisms. And then consider the class of all objects constructed out of elements, maybe non-material elements that don't exist in this universe, that have some of the properties of cells and that satisfy some of these performance criteria, let's say group getting bigger through time. And then we're not concerned any longer, since we're non-parochial, as Bloch suggests, we're not concerned any longer with physical organisms, to modify his comment appropriately. If we can construct automata in the computational image of biological organisms, we will naturally feel that the most compelling theory of biology, in this case biological growth, is one that is broad enough to apply to both them and us, not just to them and actual organisms. So we'll then be asking questions like whether these organisms grow. Do they really grow, for example? Okay. And in fact, this is just a puzzle-generating algorithm. You can do it any way you like. Pick the set of the properties that you like for a set of processors. Pick the criteria you like for success, whether in terms of performance or structure or whatever. Consider the class of all organisms, abstracting in principle from the existing world, that satisfy those things. And then you can ask whether they have some property of things in the material world. Do they breathe? Do they grow? Do they think? Do they talk? Do they walk? Do they enjoy themselves? Do they, have moral rights? I mean, anything you like. You can generate puzzles at will this way. As soon as you make the move of principled abstraction from biology, which carries you beyond the natural. Principled abstraction from biology is precisely what carries you out of the naturalistic world, and then all kind of problems arise. I'll give some examples of some of them from the actual literature. Okay? Pardon?
Only for what is worth, I have a strong feeling that you systematically invent strong...
All right, let's see. All right, let's see. Is Dan Dennett a philosopher? All right, I didn't mention Fodor. Bloch has already made the first error that leads to this, which is why I quoted him. Bloch, as I mentioned, is skeptical. Is Dan Dennett a philosopher? Is Jim Hoagland a philosopher? Is Van Quine a philosopher? I mean, is it? Okay, well, fine. Let's go on with them, okay? Because that's the field I'm talking about. I'm not talking about behaviorism. I'm talking about people who take Turing to have said that if something passes the Turing test, we should say that it's... Let me go back to what Turing in fact said, since I keep referring to it. Yeah.
It's just a question because I don't know if I understood you. You said that if any program or machine passes the Turing test, then it thinks, meaning it can fool people.
That's what the theory is.
So by this criteria, say my performance, my performance criterion is making cars, for example. So I have those robots in a Japanese, in the Toyota factory that make cars. And then, I am asked if this car, if this Toyota A is made by the robot, and if this Toyota B is made by the people. And I don't know, because they think it is. The consequence is that then this machine can think?
No, because remember, this means the judge is allowed to ask any question. The judge is allowed to ask any question about anything. It's not, of course, you could always be fooled in some fixed area, but the Turing test is set up so that the judge can ask any question at all, and if, when the judge asks any question at all, it can't distinguish the person from the machine, then the machine thinks. All right, that's the Turing test. What Turing in fact said is the following, and there's a difference between what he said and what the whole range of philosophers and cognitive scientists have taken him to say. What he in fact said is, we're interested in understanding the mental, we're interested in understanding intelligence, here's the way we ought to proceed. And then he outlined the Turing test, essentially, in terms that I did. And then he said the following. He said, to ask whether machines think may be too meaningless to merit discussion, okay? But I, Turing, consider that in another 50 years, that would be by the year 2000, educated usage will have advanced to the point, or will have reached the point, where that's exactly what we'll mean by thinking, okay? So in other words, he said the question of what the word of whether a machine thinks is not really meaningful. Terms aren't well enough defined. He's trying to make them meaningful, okay? And he says, look, here's the way to make them meaningful. And I think that that's clear enough so that in 50 years, educated usage will have shifted over to that. It's as if somebody proposed the concept of the atom and he would say, well, look, to say whether atoms really are this is meaningless because, it's not clear enough. But I think that understanding and science will have progressed in another 50 years so that this is what people mean by atom. That's what Turing actually said. Okay? Notice a slight difference between what he actually said and what he's understood as having said, namely that thinking is passing the Turing test. Okay? I don't think you should underestimate the scale of this. This is not only the philosophical science literature, it's also the general literature about the topic. So, for example, if you read people like, science writers, good science writers, like, say, Martin Gardner, or the man I mentioned several times, Roger Penrose, who's one of the world's leading physicists, who has a big, fat book on this topic, arguing that in order to deal with these problems, you're going to have to invent some new form of quantum theory, they all define thinking in these terms. That's not even taken in question. Thinking means past Turing test. Okay. That's AI. I mean, if they reject AI, they're rejecting this criterion. A lot of them reject AI, but then, not because they're offering some different definition of the mental, but they say that machines won't do it. Machines will never do it. So, for example, when John Searle, I'll give you his criticism of strong AI in a moment, but it essentially takes the framework to be meaningful. I question whether the framework's even meaningful. The abstraction in principle from biological mechanisms already carries it beyond the meaningful, in my opinion. And that, there is no doubt that that's exactly what, Bloch is exactly correct in saying that that's the crucial step in the computational theory of mind. He says, I was quoting from his article, that the crucial step in the computational theory of mind is the principled abstraction from the biological, which makes psychology not a biological science, okay? Therefore, there must be other criteria for just about everybody in the field, it's the Turing test, but some other criteria outside that will identify the mental, and we will prefer a theory of the mental that isn't restricted to things like us, as distinct from, say, a theory of flying, which is distinctly restricted to birds, okay? So it's not like the natural sciences, and I think that's the problem. Well, let's continue. Note where this differs from the natural sciences. Okay, one, the natural sciences never abstract in principle from mechanisms. I mean, that's unheard of. You know, so for example, a natural scientist studying thinking, if the natural science, say language or any other kind of thought, if the natural scientist would discover that some specific property of cells, you know, some, suppose the natural scientist had two theories of language. Okay, here's theory T1 of language and theory T2 of language. And suppose the natural scientist were to discover that this one is realizable in cells of the kind that human beings have, okay, and this one is not realizable in cells of the kind that human beings have. Suppose that discovery were made. For the naturalist, this theory would be selected and this one would be rejected. Okay? That's obvious. But for the computational theory of mind, it would be irrelevant because, to quote again, it does not matter how the processors are realized. Okay? So if they're realized in cells, okay. If they're not realized in cells, not okay. No, it doesn't matter. So the theory of language, which is just part of the mental, for the theory of language, the discovery, the potential discovery that some property of cells, human cells, selects one theory over another would just not be relevant. Language is abstracted away from that in principle. That's one striking difference between this and the natural sciences. A second is that the natural sciences are not concerned about any kind of criteria, whether they're performance criteria, as defines the whole field of AI, or other kinds of criteria like structural resemblance or whatever you want. Such things don't appear in the sciences. That if something meets a criterion, whatever it may be, it's of interest for the sciences only insofar as it tells you something about the real objects under consideration. Okay, so if you have some real objects over here and you set up some criteria of performance, structure, whatever you like, and you find some other imaginable thing, some thing abstractly described that satisfies that criterion, it's of interest only if it tells you something about these things. Well, let's take the case of computer programs again, which is Herbert Simon, you know, leading figure in the field, points out correctly was the Drosophila of the cognitive sciences. Why was chess playing the Drosophila of the cognitive sciences? Well, because of a certain variety of the Turing test. See, the particular variety of the Turing test that people have who are studying Drosophila, you know, the Drosophila of the cognitive sciences means, as he explains, the main concern around which inquiry has revolved. Okay. I'm not talking about a minor figure now. I'm talking about one of the leading figures in the field, and nobody questioned it. The main concern around which the field revolved is chess-playing machines, because there's a particular version of the Turing test which will come down to the fact that the machine passes the Turing test if the judge can't tell whether it's a grandmaster. Okay. Now, the way you usually check that out is by seeing if the machine can beat the grandmaster. But you can rephrase a competition between a person and a machine and a chess player in terms of a Turing test structure. Can the judge tell the difference between them when it's watching what the two of them are doing? Okay. The thing then is usually turned into the test of whether, you know, how they make out in a game. And that's the Drosophila of the cognitive sciences. Notice how a natural scientist would look at this. Assuming that a natural scientist would want to study chess playing at all, as I mentioned the other day, it's probably not a reasonable topic to study, but assuming that one wants to study that mental activity, chess playing, suppose somebody comes along with a computer program that satisfies a version of the Turing test with regard to chess playing. Say it fools someone into thinking it's a person, does as well as Kasparov or something. First question that the natural scientist would ask is, how does it work? Second question is, how does Kasparov work, or anybody, whoever you happen to be trying to model, you know? How does Kasparov work? How do people work, if you want to make it more general? Third, does one tell me anything about 2. Okay. If it doesn't, then I'm not interested in it. That's contingent abstraction. That's why I call it contingent abstraction. You look at, or exploratory abstraction, you study some abstract object to see if it will teach you something about the real things. Okay. If it doesn't, too bad. In fact, chess programs don't, so they're of no interest. The fact that they've been the core of the cognitive sciences, the core around which all research, you know, all general research revolves, well, that just illustrates the strength of the Turing test in defining the field. Pick some other criterion, you're going to get similar problems. So that's another sharp departure from the natural sciences. And in fact, when you enter this non-naturalistic domain, the questions that arise are pretty odd. Here's a standard one which has been debated for years in the philosophical literature. I'll start by quoting from a sort of classic paper by John Hoagland, in the Journal of Philosophy about 10 years ago. Another paper by another well-known philosopher has been at the center of this stuff. He asks the following. He says, how might one empirically defend the claim that a given strange object plays chess? Okay. How might one empirically defend the claim that a given strange object plays chess? That's the topic of his, that's the first topic of his paper about the mental. And he gives the conventional answer. He says, we would properly conclude that this strange object plays, notice it doesn't matter out of what it's constructed, because we've abstracted away from biology and principle, so that's not relevant. We would conclude, he says, that it we would properly conclude that it does if a skeptic is convinced that it meets a certain performance criterion, which he describes, some version of the Turing test. If the skeptic is convinced that the machine meets that criterion, then, he said, we would have empirically defended the claim that the object plays chess. Okay, so playing the idea is this is an empirical claim, which is a little odd because this is not a part of the natural sciences. But we have an empirical claim, which is to which the answer will be that we're trying to defend, and we successfully defend it if the skeptic is convinced by the Turing test that the thing is passing the criteria. Now, the second part of his paper goes on to understanding language, which is what the paper's about. It's called On Understanding Language. And he argues there that we can never meet that criterion. Okay. In the case of understanding language, he gives a bunch of arguments to say that it would never be possible to convince the skeptic that the device is indistinguishable from a person. So the same framework is accepted. We don't have to worry about whether his argument's right or not. But the same framework is accepted, but we would have empirically defended the claim because the skeptic would never be convinced. Okay, so therefore, the machine is not understanding language. Notice the crucial point. It's an empirical claim, and the claim is correct if the performance criterion is satisfied. Okay, same basic argument. There's actually been a huge debate about this over the last 10 years or so. Just now. Go on. Yeah. 5 minutes. Yeah. I'll just describe the debate and talk about it tomorrow. There's been a huge debate. One of the dominant debates in philosophy of mind and cognitive psychology was initiated by John Searle, who wanted to show, he wants to debunk all of strong AI, you know, the whole AI field. And he raised the following question. I'll just describe the experiment, and then you can think about it, and then we'll go on. He said, suppose we had an algorithm that understood Chinese. Okay. Let's imagine that somebody could construct an algorithm that would understand Chinese by whatever performance criterion you like. Okay. Now, suppose that you make a room, and in it you put John Searle. Okay, John Searle, by assumption, doesn't understand any Chinese. Okay, he actually sets this up in Turing test terms, but I'll skip that to save time. You feed in. Suppose that the test you're trying to provide is you give a sentence a question in Chinese, and you're supposed to give an appropriate answer in Chinese. All right, so like the Turing test. You have a question, you're supposed to give an appropriate answer. Suppose you feed the question in. John Searle has lying in front of him on a table, you know, we assume a huge table, like maybe as big as the world or something, a description of that algorithm, that actual algorithm written out. John Searle gets a series of lights flashing, which are the, you know, the representation of that question after it enters the system. So there's a series of lights flashing. He then looks up in the algorithm what you're supposed to do when that series of light flashes, and then he carries out all the operations, and he runs through it all, and so on and so forth. And when he's finished, he types out something which the algorithm, he's executed the algorithm, in other words. Suppose he executes the algorithm, and then he types out an answer, and by assumption, this fools the observer. But he argues no understanding has gone on, because he doesn't understand Chinese. The answer has been given, but no understanding has gone on. Okay, ever since then, there's been a debate with hundreds of papers, several books, you know, volumes of behavioral and brain sciences, in which people try to respond. This is supposed to show that execution of an algorithm, he wants to destroy the whole computational theory of mind, like what Bloch is talking about and AI and so on. He says, no algorithm can ever carry out a mental action. Okay, so to identify the mental with the computational is just flat wrong. Turing test or no Turing test. And here's the proof. The proof is, if John Searle were able to carry out this algorithm, and it did whatever you like, you know, still obviously no understanding went on. So therefore, that shows that no algorithm can be a representation of a mental process. The whole computational theory of mind is therefore wrong, the computer model of the mind. Well, the answers generally are of the type that say, well, you know, that he's overlooked the question of speed. You know, it would take him forever to run through the algorithm, and the machine will do it instantaneously. So he comes back and says, okay, suppose you had the whole population of India inside the machine, and none of them understand Chinese, and they're all racing around like maniacs doing pieces of the algorithm. And then somebody else comes back and says, well, the point is that maybe he doesn't understand Chinese, but he plus the room understands Chinese. And then he comes back with an answer about that. And so it goes, you know, up till today. Well, I'll leave you with that question and come back to it tomorrow. But those are the kinds of questions you very quickly get into when you make the non-naturalistic move that abstracts in principle away from biology. In fact, you get even stranger results than this. I'll bring them up tomorrow. The term creative aspect of human language is just it's just an invented term, has no meaning other than what was given to it. And it was just a reference to a certain collection of properties of language. Or maybe that's not a good term, so pick some other one. The Cartesians picked out certain properties of language, you know, unboundedness, undetermination, appropriateness, and so on. I just gave it that name. Notice that creative aspect of language use has no aesthetic character. Like, it's not what we would call creative work. It's like saying some comment about a sports game to somebody you meet at a bus stop. That would be the creative aspect of language. It's completely mundane, ordinary, uninteresting, normal use of language. There's another form of creativity, something which has value as well. And in fact, if you go back to the tradition, actually the Spanish philosophers, I think, started all of this out back in, I think, the 15th or 16th century, Juan Huarte, who actually developed a lot of this before Descartes, he makes a distinction between three levels of, I forget what he calls them, mental action or something. Kind of one of them, I forget, is kind of like rote. Another is what I called the creative aspect of language use. The third is true creativity, which he, in sort of Platonic style, describes as a form of madness, you know, like Plato thought about art. And it's the third type that would be real creativity. It's the second type, Huarte's second type that I'm talking about, you know, the type that involve, that has these properties but may have no aesthetic value. As to the distinction between art and artifact, that's a very hard one to make, extremely hard. In fact, there's some interesting questions in art history about this, questions that have a kind of a ideological content. It's now starting to come out from women's studies, in fact. A number of people have pointed out that objects of aesthetic value in most cultures throughout almost all of history have been created by women, but they're not considered art, namely textiles. For thousands of years, almost all aesthetic creation was textiles, and that was women's work. So that's considered craft, not art. Doesn't start being called art or entering into art history until men start doing it. The description is correct, in fact, and it raises obvious questions, you know.
Concerning your argument against computational...
I haven't really given an argument yet.
Well, if biology is what counts, what matters to have a mind, what do you say about different biologists? For instance, human biology and biology from people of different
universes.
Yes.
Same. So from people, so some invented universe.
Different biologies, different minds?
Well, I haven't given an argument yet. Let me make clear what I've been doing so far is just to point out that the computational theory of mind is intrinsically non-naturalistic.
Yes.
And it leads to questions like, how do we empirically defend the claim that machine is thinking, and so on and so forth. I haven't given my own criticism of this yet. My own criticism is going to be the same one as always. I don't think it makes any sense to depart from naturalism, and I don't think it makes any sense to ask about the biology of creatures that aren't in the universe. I don't think that makes any sense, any more than it makes sense to ask about the electrical properties of aspects of invented matter that aren't part of the material character of the universe. I just don't think it makes any sense. Now, I can imagine ways in which it would make sense. It might make sense through the normal kind of abstraction that goes on in the sciences. Like, for example, mass points don't exist in the universe. Nevertheless, it makes perfect sense to study the behavior of mass points under Newton's laws. A form of mathematics, which is perfectly well worth pursuing, because it meets this criterion. It tells you something about the actual world. But if somebody were to create entities that don't exist, like mass points, and create laws that don't exist, you know, other laws than the laws of this universe, and study what happens in that invented universe under those laws, and ask whether something in that universe is electricity, that would be meaningless. That's why nobody does it. And it seems to me it's equally meaningless in the case of psychology. And I think making this first funny step is already carrying you into meaninglessness. I tried to give an example. I mean, abstract biology of the kind that I described will, in fact, lead to apparent problems. So suppose, let me restate it. Suppose somebody comes along and does abstract biology, which abstracts in principle from biochemistry the way psychology is supposed to abstract in principle from biology. Okay? So we now say, all right, we consider a bunch of primitive processors which aren't cells or ingredients of cells, but we'd have some of their properties, and we think of them as mathematical objects. We set up some criterion, whatever it may be, like being larger after a certain time than you were at the beginning, okay, which is a property of organisms. They're larger at a certain time than they were at the beginning. And then we consider the class of all objects, let's say including organisms, the analog to this, which satisfy those properties. And we take something in this class outside the organic world, like some entity made up of non-existing elements, but getting larger as it... in fact, there are computer programs. Let me give you a real case. There have been studies of computer programs of growth. For example, carp are an interesting case because they apparently grow for infinitely. They seem to die only... there's like a random event that will make them die. But if you look at the distribution of carp in a big lake, they're distributed. Their distribution, the weight distribution, can be predicted pretty closely on the assumption that they grow infinitely and a random event strikes them down every once in a while. That gives you a pretty good model. So people have therefore studied carp growth by computer programs, just making the fish, you know, I don't draw very well, but making the fish a little bit bigger each time in a computer model. And then saying, okay, that's a model of carp growth, and we get a model of carp distribution by throwing in a random event which knocks some of them out every once in a while. So we get a model for the carp in a lake. All right, so that meets these conditions. Okay, we picked certain processors. In this case, they're Turing machine processors because we're modeling it in a computer. We picked a performance criterion, namely getting a little bigger and looking kind of like a carp and, you know, being shot down by a random event every once in a while. And then we get we have the class of things that have that property, including carp and including these computer algorithms, and we're interested in all of them. Now, of course, this is done seriously. It's done in order to teach you something about growth. But suppose it was abstraction in principle. Then we would have funny questions, like, do these carp grow, the ones in the computer program? Do the things in the computer program grow? I suppose somebody asked what Hoagland asks. How could I empirically defend the claim that a given model of a carp is growing, really growing? You know? Now, I think that's a stupid question. It's not an empirical claim that these things grow. It's just, it's not an empirical claim. There's nothing to defend. Let me give an analogy. Suppose in 1900, you know, say beginning of the century, somebody raised the question, maybe we can construct artifacts that'll do something like an eagle. You know, they'll go up and stay up for a while and then come down. We'll call them airplanes. How could we empirically defend the claim that one of these things is really flying? Okay. Well, that would be an idiotic question. That thing is flying if you decide to call it flying. It's not flying if you decide not to call it flying. Doesn't matter what criterion it satisfies. It could fool you into thinking it's an eagle. It could be structurally like eagles. It could be whatever it's like. There is no empirical claim that the thing is flying. In fact, languages have decided to handle the question differently. Some have taken the metaphor fly and extended it to these things. Some haven't. So in some languages, you say it's sort of gliding or something like that. But there was no right or wrong about it. It's just a question of how much to be impressed by a certain metaphor. Take high jumping, you know, the thing they do at the Olympics when you try to see how high you can jump. Okay, suppose that before anybody invented that crazy sport, somebody suggested that people who are high jumping are really flying, and then came along and said, how could we empirically defend the claim that they're flying? Okay, well, it's stupid. It's not an empirical claim. I mean, you can call that stuff flying if you like. You cannot call it flying if you like. It happens, I was told once when I talked about this in class, that in Japanese it's called flying. Okay, in English it's called jumping. But is there any empirical issue at stake? I mean, there's no empirical issue. It's just a question of how to extend a metaphor. Similarly, to ask whether the carp are growing is a question of how to extend a metaphor. Suppose we say in English, I don't know what you say in Spanish, but in English you say that a submarine sets sail. You don't say a submarine swims. Okay, so set sail. Everyone know what I mean? Somebody translate it. No, it's not Navigar. It's like a sailboat. When you have a sailboat and you get going, you put the sail up. And then the sailboat goes. That's called setting sail. Okay, setting the sail is raising the sail. Okay, so if you have a sailboat, you know. Okay, you have a sailboat and you pick the sail up, and the wind starts blowing. P- picking the sail up is setting the sail. Well, in English, so it's not the general thing. Yeah, okay, as long as everybody understands. Yeah. In English, I don't know what, in other languages, you say that a submarine sets sail when it leaves New York for, you know, London underwater. Well, suppose somebody asked, how can I empirically defend the claim that the submarine sets sail? Right? And say, well, you know, if it sort of looks like, in some respect, like a sailboat, then we pick up the respect. It's meaningless. Suppose somebody else were to say, look, I really think the submarine's swimming like a fish. How can I empirically defend the claim that it's swimming? Well, again, it's stupid. In fact, all of these questions are stupid. And the reason they're stupid is because you've departed from naturalism. Once you've departed from naturalism, you have an algorithm for constructing stupid questions. Okay? And it's clear why they're stupid when we move to other domains. But the argument that I will give, I'll just repeat tomorrow what I'm saying now. I haven't given an argument, but the argument that I'll give is all these questions about the computational theory of mind are like asking whether a submarine is setting sail.
Sorry, in that case, if you say that it's stupid, it's really stupid, the question, but not because you're departing from naturalism, but because you're asking how it can be called. You are not talking about the thing, but about how the thing can be called.
But that's a...
That thing can be called...
Yeah, but that's the departure from naturalism. You see, once we've defined the mental as the computational, we are just asking how a thing can be called. Notice the crucial difference between the 17th, 18th century post-Newtonian version and the computational science of the mind version. The Lemaître Priestley version, which I discussed earlier, post-Newtonian version, said thought is a property of matter, organized matter, just as, you know, attraction and repulsion are, electricity and so on. All right, that's naturalistic. Doesn't give you any answers, but it sets a problem. This does something. This approach, the computational theory of mind, the one I just quoted from Ned Block's article, and the one that dominates strong AI and the rest, that doesn't give us a naturalistic topic, and in principle doesn't, because we're divorcing ourselves from the biological. What it does is ask whether we should call something thinking. Well, that's like asking whether we should call something setting sail or flying.
No, I completely agree with you. And the key test has been, besides that, a lot of other problems. I mean, even if you take it as these other people take it, because the problem that in that the test is not just the machine, because it's also the judge. I mean, in order that the machine can fool the judge, it's important the knowledge of the judge. For instance, it's important that the judge knows that he's doing with two persons or with the possibility that there is their machine. On the contrary, the answers he gets, he can interpret them as a stupid human being.
Well, I agree that that's a problem, but I don't think it's the problem.
No.
Because that problem could be fixed up. See, that problem could be fixed up by sharpening the test or something. The problem is thinking that it matters, whether you know, no matter how you design.
Yeah. But my idea was that if the test should be useful to decide whether a machine thinks as a person, couldn't it be used to decide on the part of the judge that the person is a machine?
Well, you're already, I see what you're saying, but it seems to me you've already crossed into a world where we shouldn't be. You've crossed into the world of thinking that the questions raised by the philosophers make sense. Yeah. Okay, if we were to agree that it makes sense to ask how we could empirically defend the claim that a machine is playing chess, yeah, then these questions would arise. But I don't think we should cross that border, because there's no empirical claim. It is just a question of how to extend the metaphor. See, and I think that Turing was getting at that when he said the question whether machines think may be too meaningless to pose, but educated usage may change so that 50 years from now it will be meaningful. All right, let's apply that to flying. In 1900, somebody could have come along and said the question whether airplanes fly may be too meaningless to pose, but I think that educated usage will change in 50 years so that people will call this flying. Well, okay, they happen to be right about English, wrong about other languages. But there was no issue at stake. And and moving on to questions like how could we empirically defend the claim or any of this other stuff is just often to...
No, I wasn't saying that that's an empirical question which can be decided empirically. In the contrary, I was aiming at this. Since this is a stipulation, you cannot just decide that the machine decide that you call thinking what a machine does, but you can decide that what a person does, that someone who is a person is a non-person.
By the Turing test. By the Turing test.
Yes, of course.
Well, yeah, sure. If the judge confuses, you're right. That's the part of the logic of the Turing test, is that if the judge, but of course, Turing and the AI community and the philosophers who are involved in this stuff wouldn't object to that, because for them, being thinking, having mental properties, which is being a person basically, just is carrying out certain software. That's intrinsic to the computer model of the mind. The computer model of the mind, which. Well, let me repeat what Bloch says. He says, if we manage to construct automata in our computational image, that means we construct that class K, meeting the right kind of criteria, then we will naturally feel that the most compelling theory of the mind, hence the most notice that includes everything about persons as distinct from rock, you know, bees or something, we will naturally feel that the most compelling theory of the mind is one that is general enough to apply both to them and us. So the result that you're pointing to, namely that people will be identified with machines, is exactly the result he wants, because the more compelling theory will be one that includes both them and us. So yeah, that's true, and that does follow from a non-naturalistic approach. Just as somebody might claim, taking the same approach, that the most naturalistic theory of the most compelling theory of growth is the one that includes that computer model of CARP as well as CARP. Okay.
Last question I have to ask. Then,